Couple of things here. Number one, 665 points down on the Dow is, yes, a lot. Number two, this is totally normal, good even. Number three, and for the umpteenth time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the entire American economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. It is Friday, the 2nd of February. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. For the record, it was 665.75 points that the Dow fell today. You round that up to 666. You may draw your own satanic conclusions. Me? I'm going to stick with this. Number one, stocks had been going up way too far, way too fast. Number two, the jobs report today. Number three, you know, look, there's a zillion things it could have been. We're going to talk about some of them and the rest of the week gone by in the American and global economies in the next 5 or so minutes of live radio. We're going to do it with Lee Gallagher. She's at Fortune Magazine. Anna Swanson writes for the New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lee, let me ask you this. 200,000 new jobs. The jobless rate holds at a very low 4.1%. We'll talk about wages in a little bit with Mitchell Hartman, but what's not to like with this?
No, it's true. I mean, the market and the economy are two very different things. The economy is doing really, really well right now. I mean, the jobs picture is great. Earnings are strong. For once, the first time in a long time, the world's kind of the geopolitical, the markets around the world right. are kind of growing in sync. CEOs are very, very optimistic, more so than they've been in 7 years. And so, and there's little risk on the big picture. So, you know, and this jobs number today was great by any measure. Wages, you mentioned, we'll talk about it later, but up for the first time, 2.9%, the biggest gain in years.
So, Anna, give me the global perspective on this, will you? I mean, you were up in Canada this week and last, I suppose, covering the NAFTA negotiations. It is, for the first time in a very long time, a rising global economy. That's got to help us out.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a really important point, as Lee mentioned, that global stock markets around the world are rising. It's not just in the United States. So as the president was touching down in Davos last week, the Swiss stock market was also hitting all-time highs. And so were markets in Hong Kong and Frankfurt. You know, it's not just due to the Trump bump. It's really due to this global growth that we're seeing now in easy credit. And as that ends, the bull run might here, too.
Right. So, Lee, on that idea of easy credit, let's look for a second at the bond market, not to get down in the weeds, but interest rates are going up. The 10-year yield is up a bit. That is part of what happened today, right? People are looking at bonds and going,
That's a big part of what happened today. And the big fear is that this may signal inflation coming and this may signal interest rates rising. We've been living in this wonderful low interest rate environment. And, you know, I don't think this is a coincidence that it's Janet Yellen's last day literally today. And, you know, it's almost as if, like, you know, this is what happens when the calm, competent, super powerful woman, I don't want to genderize things here, but doesn't claim any credit.
That's part of what's going on. Yeah, absolutely.
All of a sudden, you know, people, you know, all of a sudden she's leaving. Wait, she's leaving? What? You know, and like the market has a total freak out.
Right. Even though it's widely expected that soon to be Chair Powell is not going to change her interest rate outlook at
yes.
all. Right? I mean, he's got regulatory issues, but interest rates are not going to change on her.
Right. But nevertheless,
freak out. You're absolutely right. It's a totally fair point. Anna, let me pull you back to NAFTA for a minute and uncertainty over where we stand on global trade. The president has pulled us out of TPP, as you know. He keeps saying NAFTA, maybe we're going to do it, maybe we're not. Robert Lighthizer, the trade negotiator, said this week, you know, there's some things we're not satisfied with. What is going on?
Well, after this week, things actually were looking slightly better, but I would say that's mostly in comparison to just how grim things were before. So Justin Trudeau had this quote this week. He said that imminent death is no longer the defining mood. And I feel like that sums it up.
How very Canadian of him.
Right, right. So basically, the countries had been in a stalemate over these proposals that the U.S. made. But now Canada and Mexico have come back and they're starting to discuss. You know, the U.S. still rejected their proposals, but even having the start of that exchange is viewed as positive and a sign that the U.S. isn't going to withdraw right now. Whether we withdraw in a couple months, that's an open question.
So do you think, though, Anna, that the president's advisors are telling him the economically responsible thing, which is, listen, if this thing gets canceled or withdrawn from, there's going to be a lot of pain in a lot of parts of this country that voted for you?
Apparently, what we've heard is that many of the advisors, trade advisors, have tried to make the point to the president, you know, and some people say that he has been kind of absorbing the message that it could damage the stock market, which he values so much. You know, initially, however, for a very long time, he's thought that NAFTA was a bad thing right. for the country. And so, you know, from his perspective, withdrawing, you know, might not be that bad of a thing.
Right. Lee, let me go out with you on this last question and this idea of the stock market not being the economy. And I'm going to credit Ben White here at Politico, who said, you know, they're not the economy, but maybe they're second cousins. There are some lessons to be learned from watching the markets and what you can get out of the economy. Right.
No, that's true. They are. But one of the important distinctions is that the market tends to respond to expectations. You know, it's mm-hmm. looking ahead and it's very prone to kind of the psychological factor. Whereas, you know, the economy, I mean, you know, jobs, for example, are a lagging indicator in the economy. So definitely they are related. But but I guess second cousins would be a great way to put
right?
it.
Right. Yeah. Kissing cousins. Who even knows? All right. Lee Gallagher, Fortune Magazine, Anna Swanson at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
All right. Have a nice weekend. One more quick thing about the markets, by the way, before we go anywhere. This one from a tweet by Dan Gross. He writes for Yahoo Finance last time I checked. The S&P 500 closed today exactly where it closed on January the 10th of this year. So like 2 weeks ago. Perspective. Everybody, you got to have perspective. As for the rest of the capital markets, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, as promised, we are going to dig into the wages slice of this morning's jobs report now because it is a big deal. As Lee said, average hourly earnings were up 2.9% last month compared to January a year ago. That is right up at the high end of what we've seen since the end of the recession, and it continues the trend of better pay that was building at the end of last year, which is great. But it does come at the end of a decade that, for the most part, has been really meh wage-wise for a long time, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
First, we gotta say, this is a significant improvement from earlier in the recovery, when so many people were unemployed and workers had little bargaining power to ask for higher pay. But now, with unemployment low and fewer potential workers left on the sidelines, basic economic rules seem to be kicking in, says Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group.
The law of supply and demand, a growing scarcity of labor, we will begin to see wages pick up.
And for American consumers, they need to, because for much of the past decade, wage increases have only barely kept up with rising prices. In fact, stagnation in real wages, adjusted for inflation, goes way back, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute.
The vast majority of workers have seen little gains to a growing economy the past 40 years. Wages are only up less than 7%.
That's a 7% pay raise for a household earning the median income after accounting for price inflation over four decades. Now, you might think that's not so bad. At least it is a raise. But actually, the economy needs to deliver a lot more wage growth than that. So as we get more productive from advances in labor-saving technology, we can take home more pay. And that's how we improve our standard of living over time, says Andrew Chamberlain at job site Glassdoor.
You have to have wages growing faster than inflation. If you're just keeping up with inflation, you're treading water. You're not actually moving ahead.
So this recent wage news bodes well for workers. But what about for employers and investors? Here's Marketplace's Marielle Segarra to explain.
Today's labor numbers. Good news, right? For investors, maybe not so much. That's because they see a lot of downside to low unemployment. A tight labor market means companies have to pay higher wages. Gus Fauché, chief economist at PNC Financial Services Group, says those companies probably will raise prices to make up for their higher labor costs.
So inflation, which is broadly prices throughout the economy, inflation is going to be a bit stronger.
In response to rising inflation, the Federal Reserve may aggressively hike interest rates. And Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says higher interest rates can hurt stock prices by cutting into demand for shares.
Rising rates create an incentive for investors to hold safer assets such as bonds, because they're earning a better return and they no longer need to take all of the risk in the stock market.
Higher interest rates also make it more expensive for companies to borrow money. Tim Courtney is chief investment officer at Exential Wealth Advisors.
That, all things being equal, is going to either cut into profits or it's going to cut into activities that those companies might have borrowed to do.
Lower investment means lower growth and lower stock prices. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
One more thing about that pay bump, by the way, and you got to file this really under correlation is not causality, but it is worth a note that 18 states raised their minimum wages effective January the 1st. All right, who do you like in the Super Bowl on Sunday, huh? The Eagles or the Pats? First of all, Eagles, because of course, but more to the point, do me a favor when you're watching the game, as more than 100 million people just in this country will. And think about this. Between all the action, NBC is sure to give you a shot, or a bunch of shots probably, of the owner's boxes. On one side will be the Patriots' Robert Kraft, the guy who made his money in paper and packaging. On the other will be Jeffrey Lurie, whose grandfather founded General Cinema. Their teams are on opposite sides, but the owners have at least one thing in common. They are both white guys, as are almost all the other owners in the NFL. From KUT in Austin, Texas, Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what's going on.
Tom Brady of the New England Patriots has 5 Super Bowl rings, and he's playing for another on Sunday. Some call him the face of the NFL, but as a white player, he's in the minority on the field.
You're talking about a labor force that is about 70% African-American.
Charles K. Ross teaches African-American studies at the University of Mississippi. He notes the people signing players' checks are almost all white men. Of the NFL's 32 teams, only 2 have owners who are people of color. Pakistani-American Shahid Khan bought the Jacksonville Jaguars in 2011. Kim Pegula, a Korean-American, is co-owner of the Buffalo Bills. Ross acknowledges that very few people, whatever their ethnicity, have the huge bucks needed to buy a team. But he thinks money isn't the whole explanation.
There are probably a couple of people out there that have the wherewithal that are minorities, particularly African-Americans, that could potentially become owners. But I think that there is this kind of, it's the good old boys club.
And anyone hoping to join that club needs 2/3 of the current ownership to approve, kind of like a condo board. The NFL and its owners say it is just about money. Dan Kaplan writes for the Sports Business Journal. He says the massive cost of franchises creates a barrier.
Unfortunately, we live in a society where most of the wealth has been accumulated by, white males. And that is predominantly who can afford these very valuable sports assets.
Every year, Richard Lapchick publishes a racial and gender breakdown of all the employees in the major sports leagues. He says the NFL's getting better. He even gave the league an A this year for its level of minority hiring. He says it's especially improving on minority general managers and head coaches. Lapchick says the homogenous nature of franchise ownership has more to do with exclusivity than race.
I mean, there is some degree of a group of men who are generally white and generally conservative politically sitting around the table voting to keep their exclusivity any way they want to do that.
When the owner of the Carolina Panthers announced he was selling the team, rap mogul Sean Combs, better known as P. Diddy, posted a video to Twitter.
I will be the best NFL owner that you can imagine, and we will win.
Alone, he doesn't have the cash, though, even though he's worth about $800 million. The asking price for the Panthers is a cool $2.5 billion. Even so, Richard Lapchick is optimistic more owners of color will soon emerge.
Every breakthrough position in all the leagues, whether it was as a team president, a general manager, coach, all of those were considered concerns that needed to be changed, and they gradually did. This is the kind of final barrier.
He thinks having an African-American owner could change the tone in the NFL. Take the recent controversy over players taking a knee when the national anthems played before games. Some current owners have criticized the move, but many players say the action's aimed at highlighting issues of racism and police violence. Lapchick says having a more diverse pool of owners could help the NFL reach out to more minority fans. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Keep your head down and work hard. You'd be surprised how many otherwise competent people self-sabotage.
How Jay Powell took his own advice and wound up running the Federal Reserve. But first, let's do the numbers. Had to be, right? Come on. You knew that going in, the Wawa trombones. Dow Industrial's off 665, let's call it 666, sure. 2.5%, 25,520. The NASDAQ down 144 points, 1.9%, 7240 there. S&P 500 gave back 59 points, 2.1%, 27.62. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow dropped 4.1%. The NASDAQ slumped 3.5%. S&P 500 lost 3.8%. Today, energy companies sagged. Today, ExxonMobil gave back 5%. Fourth quarter profits disappointed. Chevron sank 5.5%. Same deal there. ConocoPhillips down 2.7% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, though, up to 2.84%. Watch the bond market. We'll explain next week. All right, you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Janet Yellen's last day running the American economy, as Lee and Anna and I were talking about, is Saturday. Jerome Powell, Jay as he is sometimes called, will be ceremonially sworn in as the new chairman of the Federal Reserve on Monday. But how, you might rightly ask, did we get here? A guy who's not an economist, frankly something of a dark horse, becoming the most powerful economic policymaker in the world. It's a pretty good story, actually, told in a Twitter thread I saw a month, maybe 2 months ago, by Josh Zumbrun. He's a national economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We called him up. We sat him down in front of a microphone. We did a little light editing. And here we go with a tweet thread, tweet number one.
In 2007, President George W. Bush has the opportunity to nominate three vacancies on the Federal Reserve all at once. He picks Betsy Duke, a Virginia community banker, Larry Klain, an executive at Capital One Bank, and a guy named Randall Krosner, who was already on the Federal Reserve's board, but his term was expiring, and so he reappointed him to serve again.
Tweet two.
But as it gets closer to the 2008 election, Bush and the Republican Party are becoming very unpopular due to how badly the economy is doing. We're heading into the Great Recession. And so Senate Banking Chairman Chris Dodd decides to block the nominations of Krosner and Klain.
Tweet three.
It was always pretty clear that this was just a political maneuver to keep the appointments open for what could be a Democratic president.
Tweet number four.
Barack Obama wins the election.
Yes, we can.
And early in his first term, thanks to those vacancies on the Fed, he has the opportunity to appoint three Fed governors all at once.
Tweet five.
He picks Janet Yellen, who at the time is the president of the San Francisco Fed, along with Peter Diamond, a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Sarah Bloom Raskin, who is the top banking regulator in the state of Maryland.
Tweet six.
Yellen and Raskin get through the committee and are approved to the Fed board in May of that year. But Peter Diamond languishes. There's no real reason for this block, other than that Richard Shelby, the Alabama Republican, who's the ranking member on the banking committee, wants to get back at Chris Dodd for blocking those nominations 2 years earlier.
Tweet seven.
In October of 2010, while Diamond's still awaiting to be confirmed, he actually wins the Nobel Prize in Economics. Shelby, in a statement, said that while the Nobel Prize for Economics is a significant recognition, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences did not determine who was qualified to serve on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. I think Royal, Swedish, Academy, and Sciences are all epithets in this quote.
Tweet number eight.
What better qualification could an economist have than a Nobel Prize? But Shelby doesn't budge, and in June 2011, Diamond withdraws.
Tweet number nine.
So the White House has to go back to the drawing board, and that's where they find this guy, Jay Powell. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner finds out about a meeting that Powell has had with House Republicans in July of 2011 over the standoff over the debt ceiling. He warned Republican lawmakers about the harm that would fall on retirees, veterans, and other Americans if Congress didn't authorize an increase in government borrowing.
Tweet number 10.
So basically, they pick Powell because he's a Republican, but he'll speak up before wrecking the country. And because his term as a Fed governor would only run through January of 2014, they see it as a limited commitment.
Tweet 11.
The Senate is still feuding over nominations, and they go nowhere for months.
12.
Jerome Powell's Fed career would have ended before it even started, if not for one Bruno Ixel, a.k.a. the London Whale.
13.
He was based in London. He was making trades in an obscure market. But it raised a big issue in Washington. What's going on with regulation at these banks? Why is something like this happening so close to the financial crisis?
Tweet number 14.
Harry Reid, the Senate majority leader, is incensed about qualified Fed nominees who are dying on the vine. And so he uses the uproar over the London Whale to help break the logjam and get them confirmed.
15.
So by early 2014, the Fed was desperately short-staffed again.
Tweet 16.
Meanwhile, Powell has quietly slogged away on stuff like payment processing, these boring issues that the Fed works on that the economics PhDs generally think they're too good for. He earned a lot of respect from colleagues for tackling these unheralded operational tasks.
Tweet 17.
And Republicans had already voted Powell through once. So by default, the White House decides to nominate him once again as part of a bipartisan package of Fed nominees.
Tweet number 18.
Fast forward to 2017. Donald Trump has taken office, and Janet Yellen still has 1 year remaining on her term as chair of the Federal Reserve. But Trump can appoint the new bank supervision chief immediately. And he picks a Utah banker and attorney named Randall Quarles.
Remember that name, Randall Quarles.
And as it turns out, that's going to make Trump's Fed chair pick a little more difficult.
19.
One of the really obvious candidates for Fed chair was Kevin Warsh, who'd been at the Fed from 2006 to 2011 during the financial crisis. But it turns out that Randall Quarles, the new bank supervision chief,
remember him?
Had a long-running feud with Kevin Warsh that dated back to a decade when the two both worked for the Bush White House. Owing in part to this feud, Warsh ends up out of contention.
Tweet 20.
The other top contender for the job was an economist named John Taylor, who was famous in academic circles for having created a rule that said how monetary policy should be set.
Tweet 21.
But the problem with this rule was that if you use the numbers that we had for the economy in 2017, the rule said the interest rate ought to be about 3%, and the Fed had rates just at around 1%. And Donald Trump was someone who had said over and over that he sees himself as a low interest rate guy. So Taylor's out.
Tweet 22.
And that leaves our friend Jerome Powell.
Congratulations, Jay.
I'm reminded of some advice that Mr. Powell once gave to a business school student who sought him out for some mentorship. He told him, keep your head down and work hard. You'd be surprised how many otherwise competent people self-sabotage. This advice seemed to work for Powell.
And I'm both honored and humbled.
He kept his head down, and everyone else who might be a candidate for the job,
by this opportunity to serve,
ended up being disqualified for some reason or another.
Our great country.
And Powell was the last one standing.
And the end. That was Josh Zumbrun, national economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. You can follow him on Twitter at Josh Zumbrun. I am at Kai Rizdahl. This program is at Marketplace. We've got a link to that whole Twitter thread of his at our website. It is marketplace.org. I love that whole thread, by the way. I love that whole thing. All right, this final note on the way out today, a sop of sorts to the math geeks out there, of which there are clearly a lot at Google's parent company, Alphabet. Alphabet announced a stock buyback yesterday, precisely $8,589,869,056 worth of stock. Why so exact? apparently because that number is what is called a perfect number, which are, and believe me, I didn't know this, I had to look it up. Perfect numbers are whole numbers that are the sum of all their proper divisors, that is, the whole numbers that evenly divide into the original number. Confusing? Yes, here's the example. The easiest one is 6, divisible, of course, by 1, 2, 3, and itself. You take those first three divisors and add them up, 1 plus 2 plus 3, you get 6. So apply that to the Google number. There you go. Also, those people at Google, they have got to get out more. All right, we are out of here. Dow Industrials, you heard the Wawa's off 665.75. points, 2.5%. NASDAQ off 144 points, about 1.9%. S&P 500 dropped 59 points, 0.2% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. The executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.